Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi.
And I'm Chef James Regatto. And in this episode of Essential Cooking, we talk with Antoine Pshekup. Antoine is a sommelier who has worked in wine and restaurants for a long time. He's recently taken on a new role as sales director for Motor City Seafood Company, a financial supporter of WDET.
We talk about wine, cocktails, and what goes into sourcing fresh seafood like octopus, oysters, and perch. Plus, we have some fun with a rapid-fire pop quiz.
You know, Antoine is one of those, like, I feel like you're like an Oz of the Detroit restaurant scene, because I guarantee your favorite restaurant in Detroit, listener, dear listener, your favorite restaurant has benefited from Antoine's expertise, and you've probably consumed wines that Antoine approved or hand-selected for a list. And, I mean, you did a champagne training for our staff where I mean, that was probably the most education I've ever received out of a wine region in a two-hour period. And I think you're probably the second place. So the next most educational experience I've had is probably you as well. And you're such a pillar of the wine community via restaurant wine menus. I mean, I'm glad we're talking right now because the average consumer would never know. You know, right. The average guest doesn't know where this wine comes from. I'm excited to kind of talk today and shed some light on things that maybe people don't know.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I don't know. I have been in the restaurant wine business for a long, long time. 15 years in restaurants, 8.5 years in wholesale, and then now taking the role as sales director, sales manager for Motor City Seafood Company, which was a startup 4 years ago, just under 4 years ago. Stacy and Matt Wiseman, James, you have, amazing connections with them. And I think we're one of the first, very early supporters of what they were doing. But they literally built this from the ground up with, five, six products. Yeah. Really crazy. And now my role, because, I've worked for Great Lakes Wine and Spirits for 8.5 years. Great Lakes now has a partnership stake in Motor City. So, we're partners. And they wanted somebody to help, build the sales team, but also who could, talk wine, sake, spirits, vermouth, all the things that would kind of go along. And then obviously, like, I've taken everything that I've learned about in restaurants in my professional life, taking that kind of hospitality aspect of the business into sales, and now hopefully, into seafood sales.
The obviously interesting thing about wine is, it's shelf stable, right? That's like the biggest difference, is that you're dealing with a non, fluctuating like shelf life immediately, like fish. I mean, fish,
and
is
especially
like
the stuff that we were selling. I mean, we had wine. We had rosé that tasted better 2 years down the road, right, than it did immediately. But the consumer and a lot of, restaurant buyers have this idea that, like, well, if it's not this year's current vintage, I don't want to buy it.
Which is
not always the case. Like, yeah. Usually, rosé sometimes comes out. You generally, fresh vintage comes out before June, is in our warehouse ready to go for summer, right, for our season.
Yeah.
But those wines, a lot of times they taste way better in September, October, or even the following March.
Well, I mean,
when they've had a chance to settle,
So that's like a whole different, like, I feel like there's seasonality too. It's like pumpkins are sometimes available in the end of August, and then like try to buy fresh pumpkins in for Thanksgiving when there's already like a foot of snow on the ground. It's just like the seasonality around, I guess like trends or like what the sales kind of like marketing is definitely frustrating sometimes to what the public wants to see versus pumpkin spice, for instance, doesn't have pumpkin in it. Like, there's a lot of
pumpkin spice lattes coming soon. Yeah, it's September 1st.
There's some really interesting things.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's some funny things between wine and fish though that do make sense, because you basically, it's a consumable that's often served in a restaurant setting.
Yes.
So you're selling to the same audience.
Sure.
And you're right, the flexibility of like, I sometimes want like a whole frying fish, right? Like I want to score it and deep fry it, and then we're going to smother it like a green curry. We're going to do like a Thai style fish. Matt will often say the New Zealand snapper is a great option for it. Pound and a half, perfect. Now, I'm out of it or didn't come or they didn't catch enough, whatever goes on, he'll be like, you should switch to the, whole sea bream, the Mediterranean sea bream, similar size, and it's great fried and served whole. That communication is vital. just like when a wine will go out of vintage, you're like, hey, James, we don't have any more of this,
right,
you know, Chardonnay. But if you actually pour this, you know, I got this, a great price in this Macon, it's like, you know, you're going to love it. It's still Chardonnay. It's just not the new world. It's like, you know, it's old world. It's the, you know, the Burgundy. Or like even a price change. Hey, heads up, it's up. It's more, you know, it's 20% higher. I think you can charge more because it's better. And here's why. Like that kind of flexibility in sales is what I think is going to set you apart from anybody else trying to just jump ship and go to a new career path. Because I think the way that we buy fish can be similar to the way that you have sold wine.
Sure.
Which is
absolutely.
You're basically a broker. You're an ambassador of a fish program, essentially.
Right.
And there's a lot of ways you can buy, you know, fish in the world. And I don't think people are going to Matt because he's the, you know, easiest, cheapest option. It's because it's nuanced salesmanship.
Yeah. And they also, you know, there were a couple of things that they did very early on, which was to be able to deliver on Sunday.
Yep.
And if people had specs on how they wanted things prepped, I mean, they could fillet, they can do whole fish, they can do head off. They can, I mean, there's so many things that can happen behind the scenes, and offering that and offering, you know, delivery on a Sunday when most of our other, you know, competitors weren't going to deliver. They're like, yeah, sorry, we don't do Sundays.
A lot of those wholesalers have the fish in the cooler.
Sure.
They're just not operating.
Right.
So it's not like you have the product. They just don't open for sales. And I think what's special is that historically Sundays and Mondays are like bad days to order fish in restaurants.
Well, I mean, listen, we've heard that a million times.
Of course.
You don't go have sushi on Monday night if the place was closed on Sunday, right? Because who knows what they're doing with the stuff that was fresh on Saturday night, but Monday afternoon might not be so good, but they couldn't get a delivery or nobody called it in, or, you know.
Yeah, I think and those days are thankfully becoming more and more a thing of the past.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely like, you know, I think we're all used to the, what do you mean it's going to take 6 days for shipping kind of, you know, mentality. I mean, the Amazon mentality of the world, right? If you can't get something quickly and nobody picks up their phone, why call them, right?
Yeah.
So.
To that point, people do have this mentality of why can't you get it to me tomorrow kind of a thing.
Right.
You're dealing with fish.
Yes.
That is not a box of Kleenex.
It's way beyond.
So
yeah.
Is there very much that mentality of like that kind of immediacy when it comes to something like fish?
I mean, from what I understand now, granted, I've never worked in a kitchen. Okay. I've worked in restaurants for years.
Right.
I did everything except, I mean, I washed dishes, but I never cooked. And so I always hung out with the chefs before, after, during service. Sometimes in the mornings I'd be there doing orders and they'd be there prepping, doing their orders. So I don't have like, super hands-on experience to answer the question, but I do know from what I've heard, it's the most perishable product that comes into your kitchen, right?
Yeah, and it's probably the most, you know, because just the nature of fish. For one, we're in essentially a freshwater landlocked area, so ocean fish, no matter what, has time on it by the time it gets to Michigan. But it also has, you know, the chemical compounds, and there's ways to avoid it. You can obviously, the way you butcher, the way you gut, the way you air dry, or, you know, if you like, there's a lot of things you can do to fish to preserve its life. But typically a whole gutted fish just sitting around does not age well in its natural state. You got to kind of handle it.
Right.
So yeah, if it's a day behind, or if it sits on a plane too long, I mean, it just doesn't take a beating well, as it shouldn't. I mean, it's a very time sensitive product, and, you know, things like mussels and clams are living. So once they die, they're obviously, that's when they go
oysters,
bad.
Yeah.
And oysters, yeah. Oysters are a little more resilient. They are alive. You're absolutely right. But oysters, you know, the East Coast, they'll actually pull oysters out of the water and put them in a cellar for a couple months. I learned that when I was out there. That blew my mind. But an oyster can live out of water.
See, I just learned something new.
Yeah, it's bonkers. I had to make them explain. I was like, I made them walk me through it. I was like, hold on. You take it out of the water. You put it in a cellar for 2 months.
In what?
And then you put it basically in a crate. It's just like sitting there. Oysters can live out of the water for like weeks and on end.
So cool temperature, certain amount of humidity.
Yeah, I mean,
these are caves that are essentially on the ocean, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is like basically a farmer's estate, which can be anywhere from like a shack,
just to like wine,
an actual basement. But on the East Coast, specifically Duxbury, Massachusetts, is where I was, you know, with Island Creek, there's shallow water, but will freeze. Like the ocean obviously will have like, you know, a frozen shoreline, you know, not solid, but like, you know, chunks of ice that will basically beat up the oysters or the cages. It'll basically destroy the habitat for the oysters. So they have to come out in the colder months and go back in the water. So the oyster can basically live, and it's almost like a bird, like a migratory bird. It knows when the season's changing and it stuffs itself and it basically will live off the nutrients in its shell. Mussels, not, I mean, the mussels that, you know, brought, like the mussels from Brittany, France, are so special because of the tide change. It's like 24 feet or something. When you see the tide in Brittany, it's like dramatic. I mean, it's like you could feel like you could drive a truck out there like a mile. And then when the tide comes back, it completely submerges them. So the mussels get a complete exposure to oxygen for an extended period of time and then a complete submersion under the ocean. And that's what makes the mussels from, you know, Brittany, France so special. Because there's tides all over the world, but that right. tide is dramatic. So shellfish is unique. It can survive, you know, a decent
amount. It's a little more forgiving.
And oysters, or I'm sorry, lobsters ship live. Right. But again, all these things have a shelf life. And an oyster, I keep saying, a lobster that dies basically almost immediately starts releasing ammonia. So if you buy a dead lobster, let it sit around for a day and then cook it, I mean, it's basically going to taste like, you know, like poison. And it actually can make you sick too.
Nice choice of words, by the way.
Yeah.
Poison.
Yeah, it's true. But you know, but that's just, to me, it goes back to salesmanship. And I think what Matt does, what separates Motor City, because you can buy a lot of nice fish. I mean, there's a lot of nice fish out there. Matt does not have the only nice fish in the world. He does have very nice fish, but you can get some nice fish out there.
Right.
But the salesmanship is what's going to set him apart, which is why I think you are the right man for the job, right person for the job.
I think it's salesmanship. It's also product knowledge. And then the other thing is, like, you know, I'm not coming from, like, I didn't sell like football helmets for example. Like,
right.
I wasn't selling widgets, and the relationships are already there. You yeah. and I are sitting down talking. My world is going to expand a little bit because, like, you know, we were small. I had 125 accounts. We sold to probably 700 accounts at our division within Great Lakes. Great Lakes sells to everybody who has a liquor license in Michigan. But I have relationships with those people, and I get what happens behind the scenes. So that, some product knowledge, and then, you know, and we just hired a new salesperson. He's chef background, but then worked for a relatively large seafood company down in the South. They covered like six states, but he was in North Carolina. So he gets it too. He's like, listen, I can come in and you don't know what to do with scorpionfish. I can come in and show yeah. you what to do with scorpionfish, right? As opposed to you just buying the fish, not knowing what to do, screwing it up, thinking that we're selling you a bad product and then
right.
moving on.
Right. right.
And it's kind of, that whole idea is kind of like, you know, we would go taste the wine with the wine buyer to make sure that they were happy with it, that it was going to yeah. work with their
right
menu.
Temperature, that's the right pairings.
And that, you know, that's why we generally, I don't know if it's legal or not anyways, but we would normally never leave samples of wine, because if somebody's inexperienced or doesn't, you know, cork taint's a big thing, right? Like, I normally would have maybe opened this bottle before I came here just to make sure that I didn't have a bad bottle. I do have a backup, by the way, just in case. Pro tip. But, you know, you want to make sure that your customer also understands sometimes a product that they might not be familiar with. But the relationship gets you to go, hey, man, I need this on the menu. It's on the menu for the weekend. But like you said earlier, I don't have Red Snapper, but I have an alternative.
Yeah.
Here's three things we can do for right. you that would work.
You know, Matt just brought me octopus, and he was like, hey, this is like a tenderized thing, which is not a big deal. They basically jacquard it. They basically spike it with needles, and it pushes some of the moisture out. So it's essentially like a higher yield product because it's been tenderized. Which again, like, you look it up, it's jacquarding. It's like you can actually buy them for like meat. Basically, it's a bunch of spiky needles. You just kind of like
pull yeah, yeah, out. I've seen those. I always thought that was a gimmick.
You know, for octopus, it's actually pretty. It's a solid idea because it pushes the moisture out.
Okay.
An octopus, when you cook a whole octopus, like if you just buy one, like whatever, wild at the store, you get like a 35% yield. So 60 wow. or you know, so yeah, so 65% is water. So right. if you buy 10 pounds, you're gonna get like, you know, 3.5 pounds of product. It's crazy. So when you essentially jacquard it, you kind of push some of the water out, so you get a higher yield. So he just came to me with this new, like, hey, this octopus is tenderized. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he explained it to me. I cooked it. It's a beautiful product, and it's got about a 65% yield. makes more sense, obviously. So the price fluctuates. You know, hold my hand a little bit, explain it to me, let me taste it. Okay, now I'm all in, and I, you know, it's an easier sell.
Yeah.
And I think some of the things like a chef or, you know, Matt has a chef background too.
Sure.
You know, I mean, because some inexperienced chefs, I think Matt talked about this with us, and, you know, if a chef says, hey, Antoine, I want to do monkfish crudo, right. You know, you're like, I can't let you do that because monkfish carries, you know, parasites. You cannot eat monkfish raw. Unfortunately, some chefs need to be told that. Even halibut. I mean, some chefs will serve halibut. I see it around. Halibut has a decent amount of worms and parasites.
Right.
I don't recommend you eat it raw. You can, I mean, do whatever you want, but like, I wouldn't serve raw halibut in my restaurant.
I learned that this week. It's called a histamine fish.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, you know, I think.
See?
There it is.
There you go.
Layering up my knowledge.
Those are some of the things that, you know, again, Motor City Seafood can kind of hold your hand through.
Yes.
You know, I don't need to know about what fish to not serve raw, but the tenderized octopus yield conversation was new to me.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that, again, that's really what separates, you know, salesmanship from just a wholesale account.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like business philosophy, I think it's a really easy transition because what I've been doing with Little Guy, what I did with restaurants, now what you know, kind of Matt has developed that idea of like we're gonna have really really great product and we're gonna know everything we can about it to make sure that it sells, right? I mean, that's the ultimate goal. That idea is, you know, was like, that was one of the easiest job transitions for me.
Ever. Sure.
You know, well, I haven't officially started, you know, full time yet,
theory.
But in theory, that's what kind of made me think, okay, yeah, this is a really good move. It's going to be weird being away from wine, but, what? You know, I might enjoy it more.
You can drink while you're on the call.
Yeah.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
From the relationship between you, the buyer, you, the wholesale seller, James, when you're getting, like, your restaurant's a little different because you're the kind of chef that could say, what do you got? Or maybe, what do you have a lot of?
Right.
Or whatever. But then there are certain restaurants who always have the branzino on the menu or,
right.
or what have you. How does that conversation go with you? Do you say, this is what I really want to make? Or do you usually say, what is the best thing you have?
Yeah.
Or maybe for the best price, or you have too much of this and I'll figure out what to do with it.
Right.
How do those conversations go, like for you or for maybe other chefs to get, and and I'm always like mindful, like the timing is such an issue now,
yeah.
You know, it's not like other foods, you know, there's a timing issue. How's that work? How does that conversation play out so that you can ultimately make the best thing for your customer, for your clientele? And for you to be able to sell, your job is to sell as much fish as possible to people that can actually do something with it.
Yeah, for me, I definitely, I cook what I want to eat, and I like to eat very seasonally. So I kind of, I'm aware of when soft shell crab starts, I'm aware of when bay scallops are around, you know, I'm aware when halibut season starts or Copper River salmon. So that dictates a lot. Matt will send out a weekly blast of like what he has going on. So that's obviously very wise for him to do.
Yep.
Matt Wiseman, obviously.
Yes. Lives up to his name.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Don't tell him.
Let's just check his
just kidding. Yeah. But you know, so I definitely am motivated by seasonality, but I will check in with Matt and be like, hey, is there anything you're excited about? Like there's, I think it's the Elfensina. I always mispronounce it, but the golden-eyed snapper. And we talked about this when Matt was on the air with you, Ann. Mm-hmm. The golden-eyed snapper is one of the best raw eating fish I've ever tasted in my life.
Right.
And he was the one who was like, hey, James, you got to try this. It looks like a crazy giant goldfish. It's the most delicious thing ever. So I bought it and I fell in love with it. He doesn't get, I think it's like a bycatch of his New Zealand snapper people. So he doesn't really get a lot of it, but when he does, I'll totally buy it. So he knows I love it and he knows that I'm available to buy it whenever it's available. So like that kind of relationship, is just like, you know, like anything else, time. You know, Antoine knows things about me in the wine world where he's like, hey, right. James loves that Vizarco cart 2012. You should buy the last 12 bottles of it. And I will. So like there's things that we just relationships will lean to, but I like to buy seasonally. But with all my vendors, I will check in and say, hey, what looks great? Or what do you have a lot of? Or what, you know, what is, you know, what what's coming up that I can keep my eye on? So that's definitely, you're right. Everything you just said, I mean, you're pretty much spot on with how most chefs purchase. If you do go to a restaurant and you see a fixed price fish year round, I would just be a little leery. You know, like a lot of, for instance, a lot of Michigan tourist towns will offer, you know, whitefish, walleye, and perch year round. Well, perch is definitely not available year round, and perch is also pretty expensive. So you buy fresh perch right now, wholesale. I mean, actually, I shouldn't say right now. I haven't looked in a long time, but it's always in the high teens. You know, so 18, 19, maybe 13 if it's like, you know, a plentiful. But perch is expensive. So it's without 100% yield. You just split it down the middle. It's already butterflied for you. Okay, now if you go to a restaurant and you see like perch dinner, especially when it just says perch dinner.
$7.99.
Yeah, that's a Russian frozen fish. It's called Zander. Zander. I think it's Zander. But it's a perch, you know, quote, it's a perch and it's frozen and it's from Russia. These like Russian lakes they fish it on. It's available year round. You can buy it. Sisco carries it. All the big wigs, you know, company carries it. That's one of the biggest.
But it's not really perch.
It's perch. It's not Great Lakes perch.
Yeah, it's not Great Lakes fresh perch.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
So like to me, there's a lot of that in the fish industry. So I would always, you know, and I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk when I go out to eat ever, obviously, but I've asked and I'm like, is this fresh perch? Yeah, it's fresh. I'm like, I was like, okay, like really? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, are you sure? And like, I literally was like, I've one time, one, and I'm not proud of it. I once was like, I want to see it. I was like, go get it. Go get me the raw fish and show me. And then she came back and was like, no, it's, you know, it's frozen. It's previously frozen. And it was a Zender. And like, I'm not against eating that product, but I'm just like, I will go with a fresh whitefish or a fresh walleye over, you know what I'm saying? Like, tell me what is, and honestly, most of these bartenders or servers will just tell you straight up, like, yeah, you know what? You should get the whitefish. It's the best right now. So most of these like small town, you know, fish spots will tell you, like, you know, I go to Scalawags, which is this like, is in I'm not a big fan of Mackinac City. I'm sure the three of us aren't, you know, it's a very touristy, fudge driven town. And that's not really my speed. But Scalawags is this little gem in Mackinac City where they just serve up just really simple fried fish, whitefish chowder, fried walleye. It's just like, it's just good fried fish. And just ask them, just ask the kid behind the counter. He'll tell you, oh, you know, the walleye came in really fresh. Get the walleye. Like most places will tell you.
Right.
Sometimes it's like, what do you know that I don't? Who is ice fishing perch for this restaurant?
Right.
Sometimes it's like a legit, like, wait a second, I want to go down this rabbit hole. And I've been, you know, I remember, I think when Sarah Welch was at Republic, she was the one that told me about the carrots in dirt at Cherry Capital. They will like store the carrots in the dirt over the winter and harvest them as they go. You know, basically you bring in basically a trough of dirt with carrots in them.
Like a raised bed?
More or less, but it's like essentially out of the ground and it's like in a barn or something.
Cool.
So I was unaware that you could get carrots all winter long from Cherry Capital. And so like there's moments where I'm like, wait a second, explain yourself. And I'm not grilling you because I'm like mad. I'm like,
no,
educate
like, wow,
me
yeah.
so I can then use this product as well.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I will do when I go out is like when I go to, because I like a gin and tonic is a great, I don't know this bar or trust this bar cocktail.
Yes.
But
we all
I
have
also,
our benchmarks.
I've gotten to the point where I'm like, what kind of tonic do you pour? Because a lot of times, for one, gin and tonic is not a very popular drink in a, you know, in a weird establishment or like a dive bar or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, I'm always like crossing my fingers that it's like a little, you know, like the little individual 8 ounce Schweppes or like, you know, hopefully Fever Tree, but doubtful, you know, but whatever Schweppes or, you know, some kind of small, just at least small. And whenever you see them pull out like the 1 liter and it's like a third left, I'm like, oh my God. You know?
Or the gun.
Yeah,
I mean,
honestly though, I'll take the gun for the CO2 level.
Yes.
Because I don't expect to get a great tonic flavor, but like it's most about the carbonation. And I go to some places and I'm like, if I get a gin and tonic, it's just like dead flat. And I'm like, ugh.
Well, so brands like Fever Tree that are really interesting. So they came out with 150 milliliter cans, but their normal size was 200 milliliters because the gin and tonic should be about you know, one quarter to three quarters spirit to, and generally served in a bigger glass, right? If you get it, you know, especially in Spain, which you wouldn't think gin and tonic
is the drink of Spain.
Essentially the national drink outside of obviously wine and sangria and sherry and things like
gin and tonic is the drink in Spain.
If you go to Madrid, every second bar has a massive menu of gin and tonics with like all these different kinds of gin. All these different kinds of tonic.
Garnishes.
I mean, we stayed in this incredible hotel in Madrid that they pour it into the glass. The wine glass they poured it into was probably cost more than the booze and the mixers and the garnish and the ice. And I'm like, okay, you know that you're getting a proper. Oh, yeah. So like glassware, again, you know, we go back to this. This is why, not that I didn't think you would have glassware here, but I figured, you know, why not? Glassware is hugely important too.
Oh, it's huge. You know, if you go to Jose Andres, any of his restaurants, Bazaar in Hollywood for one, I think it's Hollywood. It might just be outside, maybe West Hollywood or even probably downtown LA. I can't remember, but Jose Andres restaurants have like such a gin and tonic experience because obviously he's a Spanish chef. But yeah, I mean, I remember like it's like a terrarium of like little tiny garnishes on crazy ice cubes, and they just give you a bottle of tonic and then like the gin in a carafe, and you basically like mix it to your leisure and like it's just
your own.
To me, I mean, like, but I will order a gin and tonic at a generic wedding too. And just, I'm not that big of a diva. I really just want carbonation and like a thinned out gin essentially.
Right.
But I feel like there's nothing worse than a flat tonic, you know, and it just tastes like terrible Sprite essentially.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But
most of it's way too sweet anyways.
I know. Yeah. I know. What is your, you're at a wedding with a not so good bar.
It's funny. Usually gin and tonic.
Okay.
Yeah. But then now like I kind of look like, oh, what kind of tonic do they
have? Yeah, I know. I've never thought I'd become like a tonic diva. You know, you could give me the worst gin in the world, but with a great tonic, I'd be like, okay, fine, I can deal with that.
But then you kind of survey, like the last wedding I went to, it's been a couple years. Most of my friends are already either married or you know, long since divorced.
Second marriages coming in. Oh, yeah.
Maybe
that.
Second marriages. You don't always get invited to those, and you don't always want to go to those either.
That's true.
But they had Dolan, they had, you know, this dry vermouth that we sell that's fantastic, and they were pouring pretty great sparkling wine. So I was doing dry vermouth and sparkling wine in a highball,
like a
kind
spritz.
Of yeah.
That's nice.
Which was great because it's low alcohol too.
Yeah,
so, you know, exactly. Somebody's got to drive
drink
home
all night.
Yeah.
What about you, Ann? What's your go-to? You go to a wedding and you're like, this bar is not trustworthy.
Oh, I'm like a gin and tonic.
Gin and tonic, yeah.
It sounds right. The safest.
Yeah. And it usually is.
It sounds like.
Especially at a busy bar.
Give me a little lime to make sure.
Yeah.
And yeah, gin and tonic for sure.
Yeah, I like when they're like when they're really busy because you're like, oh yeah, they're just crushing through soda and tonic, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the ice is fresh.
Yeah, yeah. They're just busy. I love a busy bar.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right, so I got a couple, and I'm sure, Ann, you probably have, like I said, more intelligent things to say than I do.
No.
But I always like picking your brain because you always have great. I want to give you two choices on a couple of things, and I want you to answer me as quick as you can, and it doesn't need to be too in-depth. But cheap champagne or expensive cava?
Expensive cava, like without a doubt.
Right. Pilsner or IPA?
Pilsner, 100%.
Okay. Green chartreuse or yellow chartreuse?
Okay. So, I mean, if I have to.
Yeah, I'm pouring you one right now. You only get one.
It's going to be green, although I do love yellow.
Okay.
But yeah, but yellow tends to me to be a little bit softer and too sweet, whereas I like the higher herbal balance of green.
Favorite vodka?
Oh, man.
I know, it's a weird cut. That's probably, favorite vodka is probably an oxymoron, but.
That's a tough one. I mean, I don't even know. Can I answer this? Sid, are you listening? favorite vodka? I mean, unfortunately, you might have to cut this out. It's probably Ketel One.
Okay.
That's one of our competitors. I don't know. I don't like Tito's. It's not even because they're just everywhere, and I feel like they're like they inundated the market. But I just don't think it tastes very good.
Yeah.
Honestly, I drink the Kirkland brand, the French Kirkland brand.
Kirkland is dominating the liquor scene right now. It's crazy.
I mean, we've done blind tastings. It's actually pretty.
No, I know
good.
Kirkland
it's got some texture. It's not
Kirkland
hot.
Kirkland holds their own, man. That's no question. All right. McDonald's or Burger King?
Neither.
Now, come on, you got to answer.
For what?
Doesn't matter.
Filet-O-Fish?
You and I are starving, and there's two places.
Matthew Wiseman said
he likes the Filet-O-Fish.
He had good things to say about the Filet-O-Fish.
I don't mind the Filet-O-Fish.
There you go, so McDonald's.
I mean, yeah, if I had to pick, yeah, I'd probably go McDonald's.
All right, McCone or Chablis?
Chablis, but it's a minefield. Okay, so I know this is rapid round, but the Chablis, when it's great, better than Macon. But there's a lot more good Macon out there and available from great producers that are just undiscovered.
Right.
And there's a lot more organics going on down in Macon than there are in Chablis. So it kind of depends. Like if I had to pick one, like we're talking Premier Grand Cru from a really kick-ass producer, like Gilbert Peak, yeah, Chablis. But it, like in general, and then price point wise too, if I'm in a restaurant, like if there's a deep white Burgundy list, the Macon list, there's always going to be a gem. Whereas like Chablis, you're going to pay twice.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Expensive Napa cab or
yes,
moderately priced Bordeaux.
Probably moderate price Bordeaux from the right bank.
All right.
Yeah,
that's good. I like that.
Because I'd rather drink two things with a group than one expensive bottle.
Yeah.
And I'm often disappointed by Napa unless it's old and it's from a not hot vintage.
Okay.
Too much alcohol, too much oak, just in general for my palate. Love to sell it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would have to go Bordeaux.
These are good.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite glass of wine you've ever had? Or I've asked Madeline Trevon this and she had a great answer, but death row, it's over. You have one bottle of wine you can obviously open, right? Or glass of wine. But you know, what is your last death row or desert island? Because you're a nice guy, you'd probably never be on death row. Desert island, one bottle can be dropped from a helicopter down to you, parachuted, one bottle of wine. What is your last bottle of wine?
So it would be champagne. Definitely. And it would probably be,
amen,
it would probably be the same bottle that really got me to like first close my eyes and go, wow, which was 82 Salon. I was a server. I was like 21. It was one of those like, you know, kind of like crusty old dude, like Food and Wine Society in this place in Chicago. They brought all their wine for lunch. And they had multiple bottles of 82 Salon and they, you know, I'm helping with wine service, opening, learning how to open older bottles. And he's like, have a glass. And it was the first time I stuck my nose in a glass. Like I grew up around wine, drinking pretty good wine, even as like a teenager, you know, little sips here and there with my uncle and my family in France. But that was the first time I was like, wow. Like I had no idea that wine could, and that's what's so great about champagne, because it's the five senses, right? Like you can even hear it, you know, if you stick your ear to the glass.
Oh my gosh, beautiful. Doesn't make you want champagne so bad.
Yeah.
I was going to bring some, but I didn't know if I could keep it
82
cold.
82 Salon, so. You could absolutely bring
it. No. I trust me. I don't even know where I would find that. Yeah. You'd have to go online.
If anyone has any 82 Salon, please FedEx it to Andalisi Essential Cooking, WDT right? Studios.
Yeah.
We will reconvene for that.
So, you know, I don't know if that would be the bottle, but like if I had to pick one bottle, you know, the bottle that got me that much into it where I would go, wow, because I was on a different career path. I mean, I was in restaurants forever, grew up around food and wine, but I was on my way to medical school. I was actually 6 months away when I decided to go back into the restaurant business.
Yeah.
But that was the one memory of my like early restaurant career that made me go, okay, like this is something that I can – that will get me up in the morning, you know? I can still almost like kind of smell it.
Damn,
you know?
Clearly.
Yeah.
What do you think? So let's say somebody out there is like an open-minded person, average American, walking the earth, that's like indifferent to wine. What do you think? I mean, because mine is, I don't want to say champagne, but what do you think is the one wine that you would say, like, what is the one worm on the hook for the average American walking the earth where you're like, wine's cool, man. You'll like it. And they're like, okay, prove it. What's the one thing you're pouring? What is the worm in the hook of the wine world to the average American? American.
I would probably say some sort of rosé from Provence, because I think it's not just a glass of wine. It also sparks a conversation, because I still, you know, even as our level of knowledge and the customer base and, you know, I guess the just the general interest in wine as it evolves, people still think that pink wine is sweet.
Yeah.
Right.
Good point.
And so you can pour like especially structured Provence rosé that can, you know, can age.
Yeah.
In that right window. I mean, you can serve it all year round. You could do it in December. You can do it.
Yeah. And you're talking about it's red grapes, but it's kind of to the white wine.
So you've got
palette.
Structure and texture, and you've got fruit, but it could be a little bit chilled. I think, you know, the biggest thing where people get turned off with wine is bad service, right? They're drinking white wine way too cold. They're drinking red wine way too hot.
Right.
Right. Never in the middle. And, you know, if red wine's too hot or too cold, it comes off as too tannic or too tannic, right? Or it doesn't smell like anything if it's too cold.
So what rosé from Provence right now you think is drinking?
I have a soft spot in my heart for Closey Bone.
Yeah, and that's on a lot of lists.
Which is an amazing property.
That's around, though. Closey Bone, you can get that at a lot of restaurants.
You can, and you can find it at pretty much any top retailer.
So Closey Bone, that's Cibonne.
Yep.
And so from Provence, France.
Right.
Obviously, it snuggles with the border of Italy. I think that if, you know, we can make a trade, and I think Italy should take Provence because it's the best part of France, in my opinion.
There's been a border shift, a thin border.
But that's a good, so Closey Bone rosé right now available in a lot of stores. What temperature would you serve that?
So I would treat it more like a serious white wine, probably like 45.
Yeah,
and so then let it warm up, and don't be afraid to decant either.
Okay.
Like a good decanter that, you know, can hold just a bottle of wine. Just pulling the cork, pouring it into the decanter can wake up the wine, you know, like you wouldn't believe. And it can also warm it up pretty quickly. So if it's a little bit too cold.
So put it in the fridge overnight. You pull it out dinner the next day. You pour it into a decanter. You can even pour it into like a water pitcher. You don't have to go buy a decanter.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And just kind of swoosh it around a little bit.
Yep.
Pour it in your glass. And if you let it sit for probably 3 minutes, it's probably at that 45 degrees.
Yep.
So if anybody out there's that's listening wants to get into wine, Closey Bone Rosé, 45 degrees, decant a little bit, close your eyes, put it to your lips. If you don't like it, there's no hope for you.
Well, especially if you have a party of six, forget the decanter. Just pour everybody 4 ounces and everybody's going to be happy.
But there's a reason why that bottle of wine is on a ton of lists around town. We've carried it a bunch.
Yeah, it's one of those wines that, you know, we think rosé, we think Memorial Day to Labor Day. It's like that doesn't work.
Like white pants.
Right. Right. Is that still a rule?
I don't know.
I don't wear a lot of white pants.
What is it, man?
It's still a rule.
Okay, still a rule.
We'll still talk about it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we have bigger things and more important things to think about.
Yeah,
but
right.
I would agree.
Still apparently a rule.
Yeah. What about pink pants in after Labor Day?
Pink pants and white wine. That's what you go to.
There you go.
Pink pants all year round.
Yeah.
Pink pants and rosé all year round. Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
And thank you for the wine. Cheers indeed.
Absolutely. Do you want another?
I'll have another little splash. Thank you. Our thanks to Antoine Pacheckup for joining us, to you for listening.
And we would like to thank La Marca Prosecco for their support. From the hills of Veneto, Italy, you can never go wrong with Prosecco, whether it's in a spritz or drinking straight.
Joan Isabella is our executive producer, with producer David Lyons. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Sam Bobian. Original music by the Mallet Brothers. This is a production of WDET, Detroit's NPR station.